The following message is from the Daily Chapel at Baptist Bible College in Clark Summit, Pennsylvania. You can visit us on the web at www.bbc.edu.
Let's return to the book, the Song of Solomon. Maybe in transition to begin, part of what this series is about is making our language of love biblical again. Is returning to a Bible-based view of human sexuality, of marriage, and more importantly, what I've been trying to emphasize is how that develops and the influence of our culture upon the development of our views and our human sexuality. I really believe that what's happened in the church is that most of what we have and most of what we see in terms of the speaking and thinking about sexuality is what in the early church would have been called Gnosticism. Gnosticism is a kind of a complicated philosophy, but the end result were two opposite, extreme, unbiblical, heretical views of pleasure. On the one side, there were those who said, you know what, this body is evil. This world is evil. Anything you can touch, anything you can sense is evil. And therefore, to be righteous, we've got to get rid of anything sensual. We're not to enjoy or to take pleasure in anything. That worshiping God, in part, consists of what they considered mortifying the flesh, which is simply denying any pleasure. You do not marry. You do not eat certain foods. You starve yourself. You become an aesthetic. And that therefore, what they have done, according to Paul, is they've denied their Creator, who gave these things to be enjoyed when they're received with thanksgiving. And Paul condemned that. And yet, frankly, I think that's the approach of many evangelical Christians today towards sexuality. Just repress it. Just deny it. Just take all of those desires and lump them in the category of lust and push them down and suppress them and get this hard outer shell of rules and of a lifestyle and keep everything suppressed inside. That has produced some of the most warped, some of the most perverted views of marriage and sexuality, and you cannot suppress natural desires. They break out someplace and they destroy you. It's just horrible to see how that works and that goes under the name of Christianity. One side of Gnosticism so prevalent. Then there's the other side. The side of the Gnostics said, you know what? The flesh is evil, but the spirit is good. And they never touch one another. So why not use the flesh for the flesh? Meats for the belly and the belly for meats. Paul isn't saying that's a principle. He's quoting a Gnostic lie, as Paul does two or three times in Corinthians. Paul, all things are lawful to me. That's not a Christian statement. Paul's quoting a Gnostic statement and saying, but I'm saying something completely different to you. Paul says it's not true that you're just made for this world. Those people were called libertines who said, just do it. It's just natural. Live what you want to live because being spiritual is not a matter of the body. It's really a matter of the spirit, so your body can do whatever it wants. That's sick as well. There's a whole lot of that running around Christianity. A whole lot of the idea of, well, what's wrong with it? Why can't I do it? Let me just live this carousing, partying lifestyle. And then I'll cavil and quibble about, well, it's really not this, and it's really not that. But what it's really not is Christ-honoring. And we know that, and we see that. The truth is always balance down the middle and avoiding the extremes. The truth is always hard to walk in. It's always hard to maintain. It requires the study of the Word of God, not pulling a verse from here and there. Not letting the culture drive you and not running from the culture. If you're running from the culture, it's driving you as much as if you're following the culture. It's finding the path of beauty, what God created. This creation is meant to drive you to your Creator. The desires and appetites God put inside of you were meant to drive you to your Creator. And that's what this book is about. Chapter 1 what I want to do. Yesterday we talked a lot about the context and some about the structure of the drama. Today I want to talk more about the structure and talk about one of the emphases of this book is the Shulamite. You begin and end with her. And the book follows her growth and her development. And one of the best ways to study a book like this is to watch how characters change. And what we find is the Shulamite character, as we open up the book, is a young girl who's torn and she's troubled. She's torn because she finds herself in the palace of the king. She finds herself under the influence of that harem, sometimes called the Daughters of Jerusalem, who are a very worldly influence on her, which I want to show you today. And she's torn because she's come from the countryside. She has that lover. But she's in this society now, this civilization in the palace that is so attractive and so appealing, so powerful, so wealthy, so sweeping you off your feet. It looks so good. I'm just amazed at the power, for instance, that magazines have on teenagers. We show them these images of pencil-thin women who only look good under certain light with certain pictures, who've got bone structure that looks really great when you paint it just right. And we put them in these elegant gowns that no one could possibly afford and put them in these elegant sceneries. And young girls read these and think, that's how I ought to dress. That's what men like. That's what the world wants. How much of our self-image is dominated by marketing? Somebody wants to make money off of you. So they give you their picture of beauty so that you'll run after it, buy their products, and they'll laugh all the way to the bank. While your life just spirals out of control because you've got to have that weight and that look and that dress and that lifestyle and that attractiveness. Well, that's what's facing this Shulamite. In her day and age, that's what's represented by the girls of the harem. They live in this protected environment where all they have to do is walk around and be an ornament. They love the ornaments. And she's torn. One of the fascinating things in this book is that she begins, though, with that statement about her image of herself, which Nick read so richly yesterday. Okay, verse 5. I am dark, but lovely. O daughters of Jerusalem, she's arguing with and continually in her speech, notice how she's trying to defend herself or withstand these daughters of Jerusalem that are the influence, the bad influence on her. Like the tents of Kedar, like the curtains of Solomon. Do not look upon me because I am dark, because the sun has made me dark. It's always in every society. The rich people you can tell because they don't work. They're the ones with the soft hands. In most societies, the rich people are the lighter-skinned people because they get to work inside. In American society, the rich people are the ones with tans because they don't have to work inside. You know, and it's this status kind of symbol. And that don't look upon me for that. Then she starts out with this, this sense of shame, this sense of I don't measure up and I'm not where you ladies are. They've been kept inside the harem with the white skin and the parasols and whatever to keep them that way. And she's not confident in who she is. And she's torn because she's presented this picture of beauty that's in the palace contrasted the picture of beauty that's on the countryside. And I challenge you to read through this book again tonight and see that every single time there is a negative image, it has something to do with things that are man-made. With the city, with gold, with jewels that have to be cut, gems to be beautiful. When you take a rough gem, when you take a rough diamond or a rough ruby, it's kind of red. It has to be cut and refined to be beautiful. When you take gold out in a rock isn't very beautiful. It's got to be man has to deal with it and refine it to make it sparkle. It's interesting, and if you read the law, when an altar was made to God, you always had to make it out of rough stones. You could never make it out of cut stones. Exodus chapter 20 says, never make an altar out of me out of cut stones. Make it out of rough stones. Don't want man's carefully chiseling off the edges and putting it all together after man's form of beauty. And every image in here that's negative is an image of what appeals to man's senses, of gold, of those things that are man-made. And every image that's positive is natural. It's about the garden. It's about the animals. It's about the trees. It's about the beauty of nature. All of those things are positive. Again, this goes back to the urbanization that was happening in the land and how it was really ruining, and here's the term I want you to get today, the simplicity of the people. True beauty is always found in simplicity. That simplicity is simply being open before God, being straight before God. It says in the book of Romans, be simple towards evil. This world wants you to be sophisticated. Know what you're supposed to do. Know how to manipulate. Know how everything works together. Know how to get your way. True beauty is in simplicity. Sometimes that's naivete. It's innocence. It's a sense of, I don't know the pleasures of love. I only dream about them. But I want them. And it's proper for me to want them because I'm naive and I'm innocent about them. So my longing is proper. But it's when I've experimented with those pleasures before God's time. It's when I've pulled myself in and allowed myself to be allured by the world grabbing me and saying, this is what pleasure is. This is what sex is. That's eroticism. And it will ruin your life. The more time you spend allowing the world to distract you and to pull you into their concept of beauty, the more difficult it will be for you to enjoy an intimate relationship in the beauty of one person. God designed for you to enjoy love and beauty with one person on this planet. And guys, the more time you spend casting your eyes at pornography, the harder it will be. You are corrupting the edges of your mind, and it will be more and more difficult for you to enjoy that intimacy with one person. You're losing something, that innocence and that simplicity that is so hard to regain. And this young girl is torn back and forth. And by the way, that's why all these dream sequences. Let's just talk about two of them here. Chapter 3. By night on my bed I sought the one I love. She's dreaming. And your dreams always indicate what's bothering you and how you're torn. Again, in chapter 5, in verse 2, we mentioned, I sleep, but my heart is awake. She's torn between that which inside of her, that which she's come from, that which she knows to be right, the simple attraction of the one who loves her. That's what we mean by her lover. Not the one whom she loves, but the one who loves her, which we'll talk about tomorrow. And by this plastic, artificial voice of the harem. Let's look at them for a moment as well. Come back. I want you just to see their voices. She talks about where she is in verses 2 and 3 of chapter 1. Okay? And then she says in verse 4, draw me away. Get me out of here. I don't want to be here. Then what do the daughters of Jerusalem say? We'll run after you. We'll pursue you. We'll bring you back. They're going to suck her right back in. She didn't really have much of a choice about it. So she's being drawn in and you begin to see their influence. And they're trying to say, stay here. Everything's just fine. It's just great. Learn to love your captivity, if you will. Notice, the king took me into his chambers. Then the daughters of Jerusalem, isn't that just wonderful? It's the greatest thing. We will be glad and rejoice with you. We will remember your love more than wine. Look what happens later on when her thoughts turn to her beloved, when she starts to talk to them about her lover in verse 7. Tell me, O you whom I love, where you feed your flock, where is it that you make it rest at noon? For why should I be like one who veils herself, i.e. these harem girls, and by the flocks of your companions? Her thoughts are going out to where he is. Why should I be like them? Now notice their sarcastic reply in verse 8. If you do not know, O fairest among women, follow in the footsteps of the flock and flee and feed your little goats beside the shepherd's tent. Go run after your little goat boy, you know. Go run after that lover if that's what you want. Then he speaks. All you are is an ornament. All you are is a possession. You're just like a horse, one of the many horses that Solomon has decked out in the Egyptian fashion with gold. You're like those, you ever seen those Clydesdales? The big headdresses and like, that's all you are that they trot out for show. And then the daughters of Jerusalem in verse 11 speak up. Oh, isn't that good? Yeah, ornaments. Yeah, we love it. Jewelry, you know. We will make you ornaments of gold and studs of silver. These daughters of Jerusalem are constantly exerting this negative influence on her. And I want you to see what she says to them. Three times in this book, she addresses them with the same phrase. First, we begin in chapter 3 and verse 5. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the does of the field. Again, she's using the agricultural imagery. She's thinking about nature, how God made things to be. Do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases. She's learning a lesson. Appetites are God-given. Your desires are God-given. When they're in the right place, and the right time directed towards the right person for God's ends, then they're wonderful. But the wrong place and the wrong time directed towards the wrong person for the wrong ends, they're sin. In the Greek, it's the same word for godly desires and for lusts. It's the same word for trials and temptations. Same word. Follow the same thing. In a different circumstance, can either be good or can be evil. It's supposed to be in the right place. Don't stir it up. I don't want to let my culture stir things up inside of me until it's the wrong time. I want things to develop at the pace that they're supposed to develop. Nothing is sicker than to see little children being moved in the direction of looking and acting like adults. Dressing up little children as if they're models and dressing them up sensuously and putting them in beauty contests and trotting them out there as if they're a 20-year-old woman when they're a 4-year-old girl. It's not the right time and it's not the right place. We're stirring up desires that need to grow naturally. God has put into animals a natural cycle of desire, a natural cycle of when time stirs and when things are right inside of them. And in its right time, it's the most wonderful thing in the world. But if you stir it up when you're not supposed to. And she talks to the daughters of Jerusalem and says, don't do this. See if I can find the next place where this is. I think it's in chapter 6. See if I've written it down here someplace where she talks to them. Maybe it's chapter 3, verse 5, chapter 2, verse 7. Oh, there we go. I missed one of them. It was earlier in chapter 2 and verse 7. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or by the does of the field, do not stir up nor awaken love until it pleases. And the last one is at the end of the book in chapter 8 and verse 4. Same thing. She's saying to these women, in essence to her culture, don't stir up things that shouldn't be stirred up. I don't want to be aroused in that direction. I don't want my mind set on the wrong thing. You know, you're living in a world that wants to capture your attention because as soon as it's got your eyes, your heart will follow. Where your eyes and your head go, that's where your body goes. You want to make a basket? Better get your shoulders facing the basket. You can showboat it and make these shots like that, but if you want to make a basket, you better get your shoulders and hopefully your hips facing the basket. You know how you get them? You get your head the right direction. First your head, then your body, then the direction it follows. It's called attitude. And the world knows it. If it can get your eyes in that direction, you'll turn and you'll go there. my wife does not always care for the way I drive. Okay? She tends to be skeptical, as does the person riding in what's euphemistically known as the death seat, you know, as you drive. Because I'll be driving down the road and I'll go, would you look at that? She'll say, no, would you look at that? Because I'm like, all of a sudden the car is kind of drifting. Oh, I'm sorry, where was I here? Oh, look at, oh, where my head goes, the car goes in the opposite direction. It's kind of like I'm compensating, you know, going back and forth like, you know, the prince of the bounding mane as I'm driving, you know. My poor wife is, where your eyes go. The other factor, though, is how do people look at you? How do you allow people to look at you? How do you want to be seen? For young women, so much of their life and their decision is what people think of them. It's interesting. It's not that way so much for men. But for young women, it's amazing how much they... What are people going to think? How am I being looked at? How am I being seen? Women live in a different world than men live in. It's a different reality for them. And it's so fascinating through this book to see the battle for how she is going to be seen. Best example of this is in chapter 6. I want you to see, we'll start in verse 11, just work our way through this, that here is the turning point in the battle for her heart. She's been going back and forth. She's had these two dream sequences where she's torn. I'm looking for my lover, but I'm pulled back into the city. I always run into these guards. I run into these walls, okay? Chapter 6, verse 11. I went down to the garden of hazelnuts to see the greenness of the valley, to see if the vine had budded and the pomegranates had bloomed. Is it the right time? Should I be married? Should I be wed? Is it the right time for that? She's thinking about that, and she's thinking about it in the right way. Then verse 12. Before I was even aware, my soul had pulled me like the chariots of my noble people. Before I knew it, my mind was turned. I think that phrase, the chariots of Amminadab, is a song. I think that this is one of the two or three places in the Bible where you're about to be introduced to a tune, to a song, because what follows next is fascinating. She is now going to be pictured as a dancing girl, as you would say, a belly dancer or a harem dancer. That's the next scene that's in front of there. Her mind is pulled back to the harem. Notice verse 13. This is, in my opinion, this is the women of the harem speaking. Return, return, O Shulamite. Return. Let us look on you. Let us see this part of you. Let us determine who you are. Think of yourself in this way. Let us look at you this way. Then her lover speaks. What would you see in the Shulamite? Like she's a dancing girl, the dancer of the two camps, like she's one of these dancing girls. That's all you see in her. You don't see real beauty. You don't see natural beauty. You don't see God-made beauty. You see her like some bejeweled, bedecked dancing girl. Notice how the description begins. How beautiful are your feet? She's a dancer, so the description starts off with the feet. And everything in chapter 7, verse 1, working all the way down to verse 5, everything here has to do with man-made things. Sandals, gold, goblets, cups, every description there is like that belly dancer and all the jewels and the bangles that are going on. He says, that's how you see her. That's what she really is if you really looked at her. Paul talks in Timothy and he says, listen, you women, just as the men have to demonstrate an awareness of submission, they're to be in submission to those who are over them, so you. But for you, you've got to demonstrate a beauty that doesn't come from outward adornment, the way you put up your hair and the jewels that you wear, but it's got to come from something inside of you, from a poised and quiet spirit. And he points out all of these things that he talks about, like a prince's daughter. The curve of your thighs are like jewels, the work of the hands of a skilled craftsman. Your navel is like a rounded goblet. How attractive is that? It lacks no blended beverage, which the Bible always condemned. Always condemned the idea of mixing the different wines to make them more potent. Okay? all of these things, he's describing her like a dancing girl. Until you come down to verse 6. If you're following this in the Hebrew, you'll notice that chapter 7, verse 1 begins with the word ma, how beautiful. Ma yafit. This is the description of negative things, of the dancing girl. Then in verse 6, it's ma yafa. It's his description of her. And it's a very graphic description. Okay, it's a description that's far too graphic for our language, so I'll read it for you. How fair and how pleasant you are, O love, with your delights. The stature of yours is like a palm tree and your breasts like its clusters. I said, I will go up the palm tree. I'll take hold of its branches. Guys, I wouldn't be writing this in a note to girls, okay? This isn't the kind of thing you'll be arrested for stalking, you know, if you put this in here, okay? Now let your breasts be like clusters of the vine, the fragrance of your breath like apples, the roof of your mouth like the best wine. See what's happening? He's now describing her. The language is just as passionate and just as powerful, but it's natural. God has put within you natural passions, not to be denied and repressed and suppressed and diverted, but to be directed, understood, expressed at the right place and the right time towards the right person. I just can't describe to you what it's like to have that intimate relationship with one person. If you knew what that was like, you would be terrified of ruining your opportunity for that by messing around with other people. You'd say, I want that intimacy for with one person. When you're married, when you're at some formal get-together, you're in one place talking, your wife is in another, and the two of you look up and your eyes meet. And something stirs inside of you, and it's like, time to go. You know, party's over, you know. It's, let's blow this popcorn stand, Daddy-O, you know. It's there. He knows. Right? By the way, okay. Let me show you something about this. Look at chapter 8 and verse 5. Let me bring in another element here. Look at chapter, I believe if you draw a line between chapter 8, verse 4 and verse 5, this is one of the great turning points. This is the point at which she goes to the wilderness and is married to her beloved. Now she's coming back. After the honeymoon, as it were, she's coming back. Notice what it says. Who is this coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? I awakened you under the apple tree. There your mother brought you forth. She who bore you brought you forth. In our society, as soon as you talk about sexuality, the first thing that leaves the picture is your parents. In our society, that's like, who can think of that? That's sick. God has made it so that you should have in your godly home a development of genuine sensuality. You should see it reflected in your parents. You should see in them a growing love and intimacy. We've turned sex into something that's about the young and the beautiful, not about something that's a growing intimacy. You were meant to see these examples. You were meant to have the influence of your parents, and we've taken that right out of the picture. We have now, by the way, I'm almost ashamed, the only time that parents enter into the picture is sometimes with this Gnostic idea of the repression of all sex. Absolute repression. Just deny it until the day you're married. Can't do that. Body doesn't work that way. The mind doesn't work that way. God doesn't work that way. But it ought to be the parents who demonstrate what that genuine intimacy is. It ought to be that sense that you see it in them. You see what it's like to have that genuine relationship. You want that developed. That it's not your peers and the world, the harem that's developing your idea of who you are, what's beautiful about you. If you want to know what's beautiful about you, listen to the people who love you, not the people you love. Listen to the people who love you, not the people you're attracted to. If you're going to those things that you want to determine what's attractive about you. I want to look like this person. I want to date this person. I want to be like these people. And therefore, that determines your self-image. You will be a troubled and torn and disturbed person your whole life. Get your sense of beauty from people who love you, from your parents, from that one person one day who will be your lover. It is the greatest privilege and responsibility of a lover to build in the beloved a sense of who they are and their beauty. That's what Jesus Christ does for you and I. He gives us a sense of who we are in Him and who we can be. Notice how the book ends up. Notice what she says about her beauty. She's got her brothers in verse 8 who never give her her due. We have a little sister. She has no breasts. What shall we do for our sister in the day she's spoken for? She's so homely and ugly. Who wants her? She's a wall, i.e., she's flat-chested. We will build on her a battlement of silver. She's a door. We will enclose her with boards of cedar. We can dress her up and somebody will want her, you know. Paint up the barn and somebody will buy it. That's their idea. Look at her answer in verse 10. A question. I am a wall. My breasts were like towers. I became in his eyes as one who had found peace. She said, you know what? I see what he sees in me. It's all that matters. He sees me as beautiful. That one whom I love, that one who loves me. Go for your image to people who genuinely love you. And tomorrow we're going to talk about what it means to be a lover and to build into a person a sense of who they are, of the rightness of who they are, of loving them for who they are, and building up in them what should be built up in. Love edifies. We'll talk about that tomorrow. Let's pray. Father, I don't know how we get where we get. How easy it is for even the most natural and wonderful and beautiful things to get perverted, not only by this world, but by false Christianity. I'd ask, Father, that you might turn our hearts through your scriptures, that you might make us think biblically, that you might make us look at ourselves and our world the way you look at it, what you've created it to be, that we might worship our Creator because of what He has made us. Not the creation, but see our Creator through what He has created. And we're going to love you, we're going to live for you, and we're going to show a world what you're like because of it. In Jesus' name we ask this.
You have just heard the Daily Chapel message from Baptist Bible College in Clark Summit, Pennsylvania. We hope that this teaching is an encouragement to you and that you will listen frequently. You may copy and share this message without modification. This and other chapel messages can be found on our website at www.bbc.edu. If you would like further information from Baptist Bible College, graduate school, and seminary, please visit our website at www.bbc.edu or call us at 1-800-451-7664.